Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
This is the legacy of Hillary Clinton. Death, destruction, terrorism, and weakness.
Hello, good morning, good evening, good night. You are listening to Politics, a podcast about politics and a limited anthology series on politics, sort of like American Horror Story or New Zealand Horror Story, which is real. We'll be doing a podcast at least once, ideally twice a week in the lead up to the election, and then we will almost certainly go away and leave you alone forever. No long-term commitment. You're not roped into this for 13 seasons. We're just here to help you understand what's going on, what we think might go on, and why you should or should not be terrified. I'm joined today by Tim Batt, an extraordinary talent. In fact, Tim, why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourself?
An extraordinary talent. I like that. Hello, everybody. I am a podcaster, a stand-up comedian, and a dude who has been obsessed with following the US presidential election this time around from New Zealand, Auckland, New Zealand, checking in. How about you, Jeb? Give us your qualifications and location.
Well, I'm a resident of the state of Florida. I was born on the west coast of the United States in Silicon Valley, and I am a political journalist for Rolling Stone. I used to be a writer for The Guardian, and I've been a freelance writer several other places. So this was your idea, Tim. Tell me the generative process here for getting us both on mic.
Dude, this has mainly been the fruit of me spending an inordinate amount of time listening to podcasts, listening to punditry, reading articles, following 538, hourly refreshing where the polls are at, just following every twist and turn of the craziest US presidential election it seems like there's ever been, and wanting to put that hobby out into the world with a little bit of a slant, because what I know, what I've detected, is there's just not enough people talking about this election, Jeb. There's a real hole in the market, a real gap out there for someone to come in and give their two cents about it. That's what I feel is out there. So it's about digging in. It's a slightly different perspective coming from someone. I feel like the entire international community is resting on my shoulders. I'm representing the rest of the globe that isn't America. And that's why I was passionate about kicking this off. And Jeb, you're a fun guy with a little bit of time on your hands now, so it seemed like an opening.
Yeah, and I'm already here for the noblest of reasons, which is money.
Fantastic.
So, but no, I like that. You know, I appreciate your entrepreneurial spirit and your willingness to jump in and innovate in terms of finding untapped markets. Your arbitrage of discussion, because that's the sort of American spirit that we're given a choice in this election between furthering or having a demonic socialist stamp out.
Which leads us to our opening question, Jeb. Now that the brief introductions are out of the way, I think the question that sums up my current thinking is, how did, in 2016, America get to the point of having an election between the two most unpopular presidential candidates in polling history?
There's the regular human answer, and then there's the sort of professorial answer, and like the professorial answer is like five different parts, so I'll just try and mash it all together and make it seem normal. But I mean, the first thing that I think would be kind of a key here is that distrust in politicians and in the media that report on them just sort of keeps going up with every quadrennial cycle. So it's almost inevitable that whomever had been nominated, unless they had that kind of like Obama-esque transformative capacity for inspiring rhetoric, I think whomever we got was going to be generally loathed, at least in part now, because a lot of these guys who become viable candidates, they start going to Iowa 2 years before the election, or 4 years setting up, or 6 years setting up a run, one quadrennial cycle down from the current one. So you've already had an opportunity to loathe them by the time they actually square off against the other major party opponent.
The length of the campaigns seems stomach churning for an outsider, especially it was cast in such stark light when you saw the UK have to elect a new prime minister on the fly, and they pulled off the entire process in 60 days.
Yeah, there is a great line. I think Bill Bryson, who is an American who wound up writing, living in England for a quarter century, said something about how, the shame of Soviet communism was that it was attempted in Russia as opposed to in England, where they're used to doing without, they enjoy queuing up in lines, and disappointment is just sort of a national hobby. just sort of like way more on the ball and way more prepared to just, run with whatever shit show is given them than we are.
Yeah.
We've managed to extrude it into this sort of like taking that small town main street parade that happens once a year. And instead of making it something that just ruins from 2 to 4 p.m. on a Saturday, we've now made it like a parade that begins in March and ends somewhere in May.
Absolutely. A multi-year venture. Anyway, look, we're digging too far into like your first of five professorial points. So,
okay, all right. So the second one would be, obviously you have Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who are now generational personalities. So if you had any animosity toward them when they first became famous, you've been able to let it, steep or I guess age nicely until you've got this great vintage of loathing. I didn't really know much of who Donald Trump was as a kid, apart from him being a blowhard on TV. But I remember my favorite cartoon, my comic strip growing up was called Bloom County, which was a political satire comic strip. And I was, I think, this only the second newspaper comic strip to win the Pulitzer Prize after Doonesbury.
Right.
But in the last year of Bloom County, the way that Berkeley Breathed, the writer, sort of got him out of having to perpetuate Bloom County was he had Donald Trump buy it and then turn it into this trash heap. And, where Opus the Penguin's body, his head got cut off and Trump put his head on Opus's body.
And when was this ending written? When was this penned?
Like 1988, I think.
Wow. The more things change, eh?
Yeah, no, every sort of act of hubristic tastelessness that you've sort of seen on the trail was presaged in the funnies.
Briefly, do you think that this phenomenon of the ability for people to have developed and matured an opinion on these two figures for so long, was this the beauty in part of Bernie Sanders as well? That he came out of nowhere, very few people knew who he was before, he said all the right things, he had a big back catalogue of saying the same things for multiple decades, and people were like, cool, great, this guy, never heard of him, looks good, smells good.
Yeah, I think, on the far left, he got his first burst of popularity when he did a Senate filibuster over, I think it was the Affordable Care Act. But it was a filibuster that went on for, some 6 hours, and people were live tweeting it. And you could watch in real time as his followers on his Facebook page went up by thousands and thousands. So you had the dedicated left had already heard about him and had embraced him. But it's something that Trump sort of understood, and he was the only other person in the race that understood it as well as Bernie did, which is, the market value that he had in terms of the entertainment marketplace is similar to one that Corbyn had in the UK, where he just said what he believed in over and over. And even if you didn't necessarily, if you didn't adopt every single one of his views, there was something extraordinarily refreshing of this guy saying the number one business of Wall Street is fraud. Or in the first debate with Hillary Clinton saying, I and the American people are sick to death of hearing about your damn emails.
Yeah. And it was sort of, I almost chalk it up to being, I was a big Bernie supporter, by the way. Not that it matters, can't vote, obviously, not a citizen. But I think it's almost that case of a broken clock being right twice a day politically, in that if you stay on message, eventually your time will come when that message has relevance. So in the post-2008 global financial crisis, suddenly we're looking for these figures like Elizabeth Warren and like Bernie Sanders, who have this big back catalogue of battling the big corporations and the big banks. So maybe it was just kind of like a perfect alignment of the planets and time for him to rise. Not enough, obviously, but did pretty well.
Or, you know, the more generous reading is that if you are factually correct, eventually somebody who looks at the numbers will go, hey, listen, this is the only person who's saying that 2 + 2 equals something other than 5.
And let me be clear, I'm not taking away from the facts of it, but the politics of the situation and the facts, as we've seen, can often be two very different things, differently relevant. At any rate.
Oh, and then just, you know, I think the third one that's very important is that, you know, you have right-wing media in the United States was a very deliberately engineered phenomenon. This wasn't the market creating something that people had been yearning for. In fact, you know, if it weren't for the fairness doctrine that was so demonized by the right, you wouldn't have heard a lot of right-wing commentary on the airwaves in the 50s and 60s because there was no consensus desire for it.
And briefly, that fairness doctrine, if I've understood it correctly, is that every single debate, two sides should be represented of it. No matter how big or small that other side is, we should always hear with equal time that opposing view.
Yes, there's an equal time rule for terrestrial broadcast. So if you were doing regular radio, non-satellite, if you were doing cable, if you were doing network broadcast and not cable, then you had to have equal representation. And so that's where you got a lot of political commentators from the right who wouldn't necessarily have been, you know, wouldn't necessarily have had like a market impetus for, you know, some sort of showcase for them.
I mean, like, it's non-proportional.
Yeah, William F. Buckley wound up on PBS of all places. So, you know.
Amazing.
But, you know, there was this attitude, and you can go, there's an associate justice of the Supreme Court, Potter Stewart, who had the famous line when ruling about pornography that, he, you know, the difference between, what was it, obscenity and pornography. He said he couldn't define it, but he knew what he knew it when he saw it. Potter Stewart wrote a very famous sort of brief that became circulated among the right wing saying, you know, our ideas are not getting a fair hearing. And so we have to create our own parallel informational structure. And then that was an attitude that Roger Ailes then brought in the 70s. What they tried to do is create a kind of a subscription service like, I'm trying to think, syndicated news. They tried to do it kind of like you'd syndicate Star Trek The Next Generation or something. They'd film these tapes and do these pieces and then send them to various local news stations in the hopes that they bought it. That failed, but eventually it caught on. And one of the tenets of that was, you know, whatever you're being told by the existing media is a lie.
Yeah.
Period. You know, they're in the tank and everyone on the other side of the ideological fence has this sort of, you know, deeply rooted mendacity in everything they do. And then when you combine that with, you know, ever since 1993, hounding Bill and Hillary Clinton, you have an atmosphere in which it would be astonishing if Hillary Clinton weren't hugely distrusted and loathed. You know, you can't put that many inputs into saying this person, you know, this entire movement of political thought is fraudulent and predatory and deadly. And you can't say all the people that report on it are fraudulent, malevolent, deadly. And you can't say this individual woman is all three of those things without there being like an actual negative result. It would be madness if that didn't eventually stick with a lot of people.
Which leads us nicely to kind of the conclusion of this first bit of how did we get here, because it feels like that's the bit where Dr. Frankenstein has created his monster and now the GOP doesn't know what in the hell to do with him. It has been so much fun to watch from the outside without as larger a personal investment as people living in the States to try and see Paul Ryan and the rest of the higher ups in the Republican Party try and fathom what to do over the last few months with this figure Trump. And it seems like it's kind of settled now and they've figured out that they're just going to have to back him. But the whole to and fro of whether certain people were going to endorse him or not, I know that Ted Cruz came out after all of the comments that he made about Trump and has come out and endorsed him now, which seems like some sort of, death knell is probably overwrought because we're only about 50 days or so away from the election. But it's some sort of finality on that whole movement. In a moment, we're going to talk about where that's all led to, where we are now. But right now, we're going to take a brief second to catch our breath, and then we're going to dive into the present time, where we are now.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
As we record this right now, Jeb is in Florida, I'm in Auckland, New Zealand, and we are both about 24 hours away from the first debate. Is that right, Jeb?
I think so. What's embarrassing is that I think you're more certain of this than I am.
Very well. Then I will, with confidence, give you the details. It's on Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Lester Holt from NBC Nightly News will be the moderator, and it's going to be conducted in Hampstead, New York. The second one's not until October the 4th, so you get a brief respite of a few days in between them. So you literally will, in all likelihood, be listening to this maybe after the first debate. So the utility of us recording this now is I'm looking at polls before the debates happened, which I'm sure is going to be just swept right under the rug as everything shifts after that first debate. Are you ready for some numbers, Jeb, and to respond to them?
Hit me. Bring it on.
The most recent poll that's come out is an ABC News poll. Among likely voters at the moment, 74% of Americans plan to watch the debate. That's a super interesting one to me. That first debate is going to be watched by 3/4 of all Americans, but only 20% of them admit that it may change their minds. 4 out of 5 Americans say that it definitely will not change their minds. So they are watching for sport to back their team, not to be informed. 60% at the moment of Americans see Trump as unqualified for the role. And if the election was today, 44% say they'd vote for Trump, 46% for Clinton, which if you've taken the margin of error is essentially a dead heat. That's where we're at right now, moments before the first debate.
This is such a fun election in terrifying in equal measure, because there are all these truisms that we've kind of internalized about American politics that we now can no longer really say are true. It used to be that, you know, basically like after the convention bumps, because you do your speech, you get nominated, and everybody hears your message and says, "Ooh, I like that person." And, you know, they get a few extra percentage points. And then your opponent has their his or her convention bump. And then a couple weeks later, it sort of subsides. Everything settles down. And then that's usually kind of the outcome. The debates don't really change a whole lot unless there's a catastrophic moment, you know, unless somebody just performs so badly that, you know, you can't help but change your mind about them. I mean, usually we're kind of locked in. And what's fascinating about Trump is that he's exactly the sort of person who can just screw the pooch on a debate so badly that he could hemorrhage 5 points. But that's the same thing that we've said about him at every step of the way through the primary, that this thing that he did, this shocking display of pig ignorance, is totally disqualifying. And then we've watched his numbers go up.
That is the brilliant chaos and entertainment value of this election. I was watching a video of a guy who's correctly predicted the outcome of every US presidential election for the last 30 years, a professor of politics in America somewhere. And he was like, based on my historically configured set of criteria, Hillary Clinton is sure to win this time, based on this set of criteria it's been calibrated on all of the elections that have come before it, except nothing has held true this election because Trump has made this such a all bets are off competition that he's so uncertain about it as well. He's not even backing his own claim, despite the fact that he's been right for every election going back 30 years. So this is the beauty of it. And Jeb, you have definitely loudly shown your own politics as well. There's a terror, there's a quiver in your voice as you're speaking about the distinct possibility of a President Trump being in your near future. But the thing that I definitely need to articulate as well is that there's a very real possibility that Hillary Clinton is going to shit the bed during this debate as well. Like, there are so many stakes that have politically, and by my personal estimate, unfairly, have been put on the table to do with their all of these things about Hillary Clinton's health, to do with their stamina, all of these kind of bullshit things, which were quite clever traps for Trump to lay early on, because everyone gets sick during these campaigns. They're grueling, they're intense, they're incredible. So it really was only a matter of time, if you say that someone's weak, they're low energy, they're tired, that they're going to get a cold and you'll be able to go, gotcha. So he's laid some very clever traps. People are really going to be looking. He's sowed the seeds of a lot of conspiratorial theories that are out there. People are now at the point where they're looking at Hillary Clinton's eye movements to detect if she's got a undiagnosed neurological condition. There's just The Clinton camp, what must be going on for the debate prep to navigate through this minefield that Trump's camp has set?
Well, I think, I mean, it's weird. You know, on one hand, you want to kind of go, everything you just said is totally fascinating and totally irrelevant. And yet, like tonight, I'm gonna pull like a Tom Friedman here, and instead of like, well, I was talking to my cab driver in Bangalore, and
but, yeah, you know, yeah.
But I was talking to, like, there's a really fantastic Sichuan place here in Tampa Bay, which you wouldn't expect necessarily, but it's amazing. And I've gone there for a long time, and I talk to the owner every time I'm there. She's from mainland China, and she just sort of told me, like, you know, out of the blue, I'm standing up there waiting on my takeaway order, and she's, you know, can Trump win? And you know, you kind of don't know what people are getting at when they ask you a question like that. So I hemmed and hawed, and then she just out with it says, because I think I might go back to not Hong Kong. I mean, I'm going to go back to mainland China.
Wow. If
that, and you know, this is a woman who's a successful entrepreneur. Yeah. And one of the things she brought up was, I'm so afraid that, you know, I've noticed that Hillary Clinton is sick. And they say that, you know, she can't, some people think that she can't be president because of that. And I had to go like, oh, no.
Yeah.
And like walk her through this, kind of saying the same thing that you did. Like, everybody gets exhausted. If you don't get a major illness on a campaign, you know, you there's something, yeah, I would think that would be more disqualifying, because that person would be a mandrill.
Oh, absolutely. And like, I've been going back watching this, I can't remember who, it might be PBS who have put it together. But it's on Netflix, of Race to the White House, which goes through about 12 different White House elections. And they had Bill Clinton losing his voice in all of these stump speeches he was giving, where he's raspy as hell. I mean, it happens every time. Every single election it happens. But Trump seems to have navigated through that probably by campaigning less. And to be fair, that video at the 9/11 event that Hillary Clinton was at, I mean, that's one of the most damaging things that's come out. But that can happen when you have a flu or a cold or some bacterial pneumonia, which
yeah,
is,
and well, the thing, so the woman I was talking to is, you know, is a mom. Her kids work in the, you know, or they're doing their homework in the restaurant when I, you know, you go by in the mid afternoon or whatever. And and I said, you know, You there were all these reports from staffers. They said, well, you know, she was dehydrated and she got faint because she dehydrated, and you cannot get Hillary Clinton, you know, you cannot get her to drink a bottle of water if she doesn't want to drink water. And I thought, you know, the first thing I heard when I thought when I heard that was, you know, you have an older woman, you know, she's in her 60s, she's a mom. She's probably got like really poor bladder control at this point, you know, because you lose some bladder control when you, after you give birth, you lose bladder yeah. control with age. This is probably a woman who just doesn't want to have to pee on the campaign trail the entire time. But you can't say that on the network news. You can't just be like, listen, Hillary doesn't want to take a whiz, right? Because that's not toward.
What was the event where she was speaking where she did take a bathroom break and that became a headline in and of itself months ago? Was that during the primaries?
It was one of the debates when I think it was when O'Malley was still in. I think it was the second or third debate or something. And she came back late when they came back from commercial break.
Yeah.
And the most decorous way that the network could point out, explain it was, well, it wasn't the network. I think it was somebody in print about a day later went and like got a map of where the closest women's restroom was. Like to the stage versus the closest men's restroom. So she also had to walk a lot further than everyone else.
How unbelievable is that, that someone going to the bathroom is a headline in 2016? And this, I mean, and it's talked about a lot, and I won't say too much because it deserves to be talked about a lot, but the double standard and the two different bars that these two candidates need to meet all the time is something going into this first debate that's so glaring and worrying to a lot of people who were backing Hillary Clinton, because for Donald Trump to be assessed as being successful during this debate, he needs to just not embarrass himself. Whereas Hillary Clinton, it seems, needs to serve so many different goals and masters and look human while doing it. It's such a higher bar that she has to meet to be deemed successful in these series of debates.
Oh, totally. I mean, like, as long as he doesn't fuck a child, like yeah. on the stage, he's probably okay. If he doesn't do that or kill a dog, he'll be okay. And I mean, you're absolutely right. And not even before even getting into the sexual aspect, like the gender disparity and the different expectations and the unfair expectations that are put on women, to kind of go back to something we talked about before the break about the, you know, this parallel news culture. When Donald Trump screws up, the people who call him out on it are the mainstream media. And conservative media has a very easy job. They go, look at another character assassination of Donald Trump. So he has this kind of dedicated news service that whose purpose, and if you look at what Breitbart essentially became, and before Breitbart's editor-in-chief became a campaign manager for him, their whole job is to make his problems go away and then, you know, to take apples and oranges comparisons and turn them all back on the other candidate. So he has no fear of error. Plus, with, you know, you've got 40 plus years, almost 50 years of demonization of the mainstream media. So when the media does its job and says, this guy is woefully underqualified, or that's an unacceptable answer, or, you know, look at, you know, if he does everything less than fuck a child at the debate, and somebody points that out, you're going to have a whole bunch of people who may not necessarily even buy into conservatism in the United States, but they've already kind of absorbed through sheer repetition and osmosis this idea that the media, such as it is, will always go harder after someone like Trump because he's a conservative. And then, you know, the media is aware of that perception. And so what it does is it always does its due diligence of making sure that it goes after the Democratic candidate, even if there isn't anything to go after.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I feel loath at this point. I'd be disappointed in myself if I was listening to this podcast and not press you on the issue of trustworthiness of both the candidates. One of the big headlines from that latest ABC poll that came out was that Trump was actually deemed slightly more trustworthy among the respondents than Hillary Clinton at this point. Is it your assessment, Jeb Lund, putting your name out there so you've got to back this opinion, that is founded purely on a historic bunch of smear campaigns that have been conducted by an empowered right-wing media that all kind of spawns from this twisted version of the fairness doctrine that's gotten way out of control and created this monster establishment? Or do you think it's based on real things, real issues like the email scandal?
I think it's like 10% real issues, 90% BS. I mean, you know, the perfect example is like, what started Whitewater? Do you have any idea what Whitewater was a thing? I mean, seriously, like, do you have any idea?
I read up on it earlier and can't remember offhand what it was all about.
Yeah, it's exact. I mean, so you have this sort of defining issue of a presidency, and it had nothing to do with anything, basically. It started out as like, if I remember correctly, it started out over Travelgate, like, which was another sort of made up kind of controversy of like White House travel bookings or whatever. And so this metastasizes over the years until, you know, now we're discussing this thing that is so divorced from whatever initiated it, and we're using it to tar a presidency. I mean, Hillary Clinton has been subject to this now since, I mean, I'm not a Hillary Clinton fan, really. I will, you know, like, in a swing state, I will probably wind up
begrudgingly drag your ass to the polls and do your national duty by voting for her.
But I will own up. I voted for Bernie in the primary. But if you look, I wrote a piece in Rolling Stone, and people are welcome to search for it and drive the traffic. But it was titled "There is no real Hillary Clinton," which, to my shame, Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, turned into an animated GIF and then repeatedly tweeted out.
Wow!
What a badge
of honor, Jeb.
Yeah, it really stunk.
Look, let's draw a distinction here. Do you chalk up the private email scandal as being equivalent to the Whitewater scandal and the scandals of old? Because it really seems to me like there's real meat on the bones. There is a genuine there is an something. It feels like a crime's been committed. I watched that. I watched Comey's press conference that he gave in full, the head of the FBI, when he made the announcements about what they were going to do and the report being put out there based on the investigation, and that they weren't going to recommend to the Department of Justice to press charges. But it seemed like everything apart from that statement indicated that they willfully broke the law about how they were treating confidential emails and communications.
Well,
so it seems real is basically the overarching point I'm trying to make. I don't want to get into the absolute minutiae and nitty gritty of it, but you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, and this is sort of like, kind of to go back to the Whitewater thing and to go back to the piece I plugged shamelessly. But
it's a podcast. You're not going to make money off just putting this thing out there. Got to get those hits, man.
You know, it's a technical violation that if you look at what, you know, like what ensued from it, it's an utter nothing burger, right? But you keep pressing on and you keep hyping this violation until people feel like, you know, this is real, you know, is a dire consequence here. You know, in sort of the, you know, the right wing echo chamber, you look at, well, there was all this classified information that wound up on her server. Well, almost all of that was stuff that was classified after the fact. So when they were exchanging this information, it was fine for them to exchange that information, but retrospectively, this should, you know, now we should not let certain people see it, or you know, these gross breaches of security that endanger the United States, there is no there. And then what's hysterical is that the accusation is, well, the Russians could have hacked her private server and gotten insight into, you know, what's going on in the United States. And of course, Donald Trump on the trail is in literally like directly inviting the Russians to hack Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. I'm going to respectfully draw a line in the sand, though, and say that I'm not 100% with you on that. I think I definitely agree that there's no smoking gun in terms of there hasn't been a leaked communique that's come out, which hasn't seems to prove that lives have been endangered by the process. But it was definitely not the correct process. And it seems like after the fact, there was a concerted effort to hide that fact from people. And she's repeatedly... I mean, they never had a good handle on the communication of the issue. They never seemed to be able to create a good sort of talking point for how to get out of it. And then it just kept evolving. And with the slow release of how the records were coming out, because it was such a volume of information, it just turned into this never-ending kind of cascade of stuff, of headlines that came out in the news. But it did... I do think that it seems like... she lied to the public about that issue.
Yeah, no, and that's the kind of pity and that of the Clintons and sort of what I went through again in that piece. Like, you know, they were so hounded over these sort of nothing burgers that they and they had a problem in the first term with leaks in the White House and people talking to the press, that they did two things. Well, one, they became they surrounded themselves with loyalists, and I think they started to prize loyalty over, let's say, probity or competence, because there are certainly some people in the Clinton inner circle who, when you get them out on their own and actually, you know, have a kind of like tete-a-tete with them, you're kind of like, how is this person this surprisingly dumb?
Right.
One. And then two, you know, they started to prize secrecy over transparency just by default. And, you know, that comes from, like, you know, Hillary Clinton in the 90s famously went out at the start of the Whitewater mess, and I think gave like a 2-hour press conference where she answered every question. And the clear intent of it was, if we just tell the American people what's up, this will go away. And it had the opposite effect. And they never did that sort of thing again. But the problem is, it looks like you're hiding something, right? You know, so you make that a policy. Well, we're just not going to disclose things. And so what now has become a protective gesture then starts to look like a clandestine and sinister gesture, which can then be capitalized on. And then, you know, as you kind of said, they really fumbled the reaction to it. It was weeks and weeks and weeks later that she finally said, listen, I comprehensively screwed up here.
Yeah, and I think you have beautifully articulated what the actual truth is, if there is such a thing in this post-facts world. It's the conspiratorial theories that are out there about this, like, secretive government that's been conducted on a private server in her basement is not true. The official line that she kept trying to push, that there was never knowingly anything going on that was sort of out of process or out of protocol, and it was all just a big kind of misunderstanding, essentially, which was the initial line, is not true. But the truth lies far more towards what Clinton was saying, and it's just this, you're right, this learned behavior of having to hide things because of being burned in the past by exposure and by trying to over explain things, that it does, it's created this whole feel of defensiveness. And the Clintons are always called these people who feel like they're above the law and above the rules, and that I really think that's where it comes from, is that they have found a way to conduct themselves in their lives where they selectively hide bits of information, and then a lot of people, because they're politicians, get to assume the very worst in the absence of correct information or timely information. And the video that came out of the 9/11 event that she was at when she collapsed through dehydration into the van is such a perfect example, because they didn't immediately come out and say she has pneumonia or she's going to the doctor or what have you, because of all these landmines that have been set about her health and her her fitness for the office in the physical sense. Because they have to be selective about that, then when something does come out to prove that they have been withholding information, a large portion of the public can think the very worst. And so it's this kind of never-ending cycle. But it also kind of doesn't bode super well for a presidency and transparency in the White House.
What's funny about, you know, the image of her being hustled into that van when she you know, sort of started to topple over, which I think is just sort of great and like such a perfect illustration of how fucked this entire process is, right? Is if you think about what's the Secret Service first going to do if they see, you know, their potential president get injured in some way, right? They're going to hustle them to a safe area.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Something's amiss. That's the first. So, I mean, that's the logical thing to think of, right? But because they've, you know, she's been attacked and attacked and attacked and attacked, and then, you know, had to resort to secrecy to carve out some sort of space for her and her family or her administration or whatever, it's fed into this notion that the first thing they were trying to do was hustle her away from the cameras, right? Or like, we've got to get her in the car so no one can see.
Yeah.
When like, you know, and that interpretation automatically works. And like, you know, you know, I might well have thought of that. I don't remember if that was my first reaction, but maybe I thought like, oh, they're trying to get her away from the cameras. And only later did I think, well, no, you idiot. You know, it's the Secret Service.
That's the thing. There's so many. Yeah. It's death by a million cuts. It really is. Because if you generally take any of these individual things and start delving into it more than an inch on the surface, you can generally find a pretty reasonable explanation for anything. But when you put it all together, it looks like this big smoky mess of constant conspiracies and headlines. Anyway, it's tiring. I'm sorry to throw so many conspiracies at you, Jeb, all at once. Should we take a brief moment and then head into our predictions, which is going to be so dicey doing this close to the first debate because they could be proved wrong so instantly. But should we take a brief break and then have a look into the future?
Absolutely. Everybody should recharge. That was a grim segment. You know, happier days are ahead or not. You're going to have to stay tuned to find out.
I think the next president needs to be a lot quieter, but send a signal that we're prepared to act in the national security interests of this country to get back in the business of creating a more peaceful world. Please clap.
Welcome back. After all that analysis and let's say, maybe it's generous to call it analysis, maybe let's just call it bloviating, but after all that backstory, I think it's important that we put our money where our mouth is. We should be held accountable for getting it wrong. That won't actually redound on us in any negative way, because this podcast ideally will end the day after the election. So, you know, you won't have anywhere to write letters and we won't have to go on the air and admit that we've done wrong, but you'll know. And that's important. So
God bless the internet, the place where you can have a huge opinion and no accountability for it.
Exactly. And where nobody will ever be able to track you down and tell you that you were wrong too.
Except that's Twitter.
We've gotten away with it completely. It's basically like if the mask could never come off in an episode of Scooby-Doo.
There you go.
It was just glued on.
There you go. So, Jeb, do you want to kick off with your election predictions? How do you think this is going to carve up?
I feel like mine are going to be like boring and long-winded, so I think you should go first.
Well, I'm gonna paint real broad brush strokes, and I think there's a little punk rebel bit in me that might be driving this, but I'm going to say Trump's going to win the presidential election in 2016. I think that Trump's going to have a term in the White House, and the reason I think this is because there's going to be surprisingly low voter turnout on the Democratic side. I think there's a combination of complacency and disappointment with the candidate who they've wound up with, and there's just such a small amount of people who are truly passionate about seeing Hillary Clinton as being the candidate, which I don't necessarily agree with that fact whatsoever. That's the reality that I see from over here in New Zealand. And I think that there is a lot of passion driving the Trump train. No brakes, as they say. And I actually think on the balance of probabilities, and again, maybe this is being fueled a little bit by my contrarian side, I reckon he's going to win. The first debate hopefully will change that, but right now that's where my heart is, that's where my head is.
I don't blame you for that at all, and it's so, you know, you said earlier, you know, this is a long election process in America, and it's longer for me. I mean, it's effectively, you know, the shadow election of the fundraising and people going to places like Iowa and people releasing campaign books. I've effectively been writing about this since January of 2015.
And you live in Florida. There's no escape for you.
No, no, none at all. I mean, Trump is in Florida, and Rubio was in Florida. Jeb was in Florida. The other Jeb, the false Jeb,
the real Jeb, the Jeb.
No. He's an acronym. He's not a real Jeb. He's a false Jeb. He's a pretender. So I've lived with this for a long time, and I have these moods. You know, I have this sine wave of mood, and I've definitely been in exactly your position where I've said, like, there's no way. You know, there's no way he doesn't win. And I think for whatever reason, I'm on the other end of that, partly from talking to my restaurateur friend, because she was scared, and I was trying to think of, like, well, here are the reasons why I think you shouldn't be scared. So really quickly. The Republicans have only won one popular election since 1992. That was 2004. The 2000 vote should have gone to Gore. So you look demographically, they're at a point where they're no longer going to win presidential elections. And that's exactly what the 2012 campaign autopsy that Reince Priebus, the Republican National Committee chairman, commissioned after 2012. That's what it said. Yeah. We need to have more outreach to Hispanics, to
that was
blacks.
The top line point of it, wasn't it? There was a bunch of recommendations, but that was kind of rule number one, that we need to have a huge Latino outreach program to actually ever have a future.
Exactly. You know, they said we're facing a demographic time bomb, and we have to do something to reverse it. And what happened was they released this, and you could watch the entire media go, well, the Republicans are going to get friendlier and more inclusive, and we're going to see some change here. And I don't even remember who did it. But it was maybe a month or 6 weeks later, some major figure just fucked that up completely, you know. And it was just very obvious that, you know, all the aspirations aside, that wasn't going to happen. And
yeah.
So if you look at the demographics, if you can make a demographic argument for Hillary Clinton, if she doesn't need and she will not get the same level of support in the black community that Obama got for obvious reasons. Because everybody is reverse racist in America. No, you know, you can make that argument. The other argument you can make is that Trump has no get out the vote operation at all. And that's something that can swing a couple of points for you on the last day. There was an article in Politico recently that there are more Trump campaign operatives in the state of Israel than in the state of Florida.
Jesus.
Because of there are the hundreds of thousands of American expats who live there via birthright, you know, who go over on like birthright camping trips and then, you know, meet a spouse because they're in some ways they're designed to do that. You know, you meet somebody and you decide to stay. So there are these Trump supporters in Israel who are very hands on about doing this and courting those 300,000 absentee votes. There aren't comparative operations in any of the states. because Trump isn't doing it. So he's
said that he's going to rely on the RNC to kind of take care of that, right? Like, that's been the Trump campaign's message for a long time, is that sort of, we don't need to worry about that. Like, the Republican Party is going to deal with all that.
Exactly. And that does that, and that puts pressure on down ballot candidates, because what he's doing is he's dividing resources. So
yeah.
The Republican Party, you know, wants to basically leave him on his own.
Sure.
I think sensing defeat, or sensing at least it being not optimal, throwing good money after bad, let's say. And so he's not giving them an out. So he's dividing resources and time. And so on election day, in states like California, Clinton is going to have dozens and dozens of offices where they can call up pledged voters and say, hey, did you vote today?
Mm.
And if the person says no, they say, why not? Oh, your car broke down. Well, why don't you tell us where you are and we'll see if we can get you to the polls? Because that's what you do. You know, you go and you find any way, even if it means taking your campaign volunteers in their, beat up old Toyota Tercels and doing a carpool and getting people down to their precinct. You go do that. He doesn't have those people at all. There are another couple things that you can do, encouraging things. I see the Real Clear Politics average has basically always favored Clinton. Trump has eaten into that little bits when you've seen the media go nuts and sort of swarm around the email stories or swarm around Clinton's illness.
Yeah.
If she doesn't get ill again, and if there isn't a conveniently timed, and I'm sure there will be a conveniently timed, press release from some Republican chaired committee in Congress about some perfidy that Clinton has committed. Barring that, or barring the media jumping all over that, if they get equal time per comment or per act, or in Trump's case, per atrocity, right?
Mm.
I think that, I think that Clinton will do well. Because even her supporters can be discouraged by the media swarming. But if they, Trump says 4 outrageous things per day. If every statement is given equal time, eventually, I think his personality will depress some turnout for him. The other argument why do you
think that's going to start happening now?
Because if you make a case that there are undecided voters, and I don't mean independent voters are usually just Republicans who want to seem like they're fair-minded, right?
Yes.
And some Democrats who want to seem fair-minded, but the people who are going to make up their mind, if you have that kind of, basically, I think that swarm that happened over the latest batch of emails and then her fainting was reporters getting nervous that they were going after Trump over and over and over. And Clinton gave them an out to create a false sense of balance. So they went balls to the wall criticizing her. And then they got a lot of media criticism blowback because what they were ignoring from Trump at the same time that they went on Clinton was pretty outrageous. I mean, because he was alive and speaking that day, right? So I think that once, when you're a few weeks away from the election, I think we're under 45 days now, especially when it gets to the last 2 weeks, I think that writers and reporters will be less worried about playing to a false, that sort of false equivalency of, I have to say equal amounts of A and B, even if B is the only one doing something stupid and awful.
Okay.
It'll just be like, there's no time to worry about it. Let's play it straight. One and two. I think many of them will be worried that they're padding the stats for who could be, the person who could be the first fascist president of the United States. I think there might be some personal will kind of creeping into it of like, yeah, all right.
You think that the reality and gravitas of the situation will actually change now, because it's like, hey, we're at the real bit of the election is now. We are in it now, rather than the spectacle of the lead up to it.
I do not think that this is necessarily reliable data. Anecdotal evidence is bullshit because it's just as weighty and just as serious as the next anecdote that comes along, right? But just watching all the because I professionally have to follow a lot of journalists on Twitter, just watching all these people who are really enjoying teeing off on Clinton just because they find her irksome, right?
Yeah.
Or tiresome, or a hassle, a bad interview, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They were having fun a month ago. And then when all of a sudden her numbers flattened, you could see some of that fun disappear. It's like, okay, let's get real. And that actually kind of flows into one other thing I wanted to add, which was right coming out of the convention, she had an almost 11-point lead. Mm-hmm. And that evaporated because when the side that you may not necessarily be gung-ho for has that much of a lead, you may not vote, right? There are a lot of third-party people out there who are, you know, were feeling very comfortable with their Green Party vote or their Libertarian Party vote because Clinton had an 11-point buffer. Or maybe they would stay home and that would be their protest. But as it narrows, the people who might have been on the fence but who've already made up their mind, you know, they might be more responsive in the polls, or maybe they never get polled, but they do show up on at the polling precinct. And
that is such a good point and such an interesting feature of this constant polling and constant publishing of where the numbers are at, is that you are capturing a certain amount of people and behavior changes for the whole group based on that published number. Like what you're saying with, if Clinton's ahead by 11 points, it's like, sure, I can afford to be campaigning for Gary Johnson or at the very least voting for him. But if it's neck and neck within the margin of error that they're tied, you're going, holy shit, maybe I need to really reassess my behavior here.
Yeah. And so I think those four things together, I think the demographic advantage, which I mean, it should buy them about 2 points. I think people who are scared shitless or saying like, listen, I can be principled on the next election.
Yeah.
But this one, I just got to go ahead and stave off apocalypse. Those two things, plus the get out the vote effort that they're going to have so much better than Trump's going to have. I think it's about 4 points. I think it's going to come down to a 4-point Clinton lead. But that's pretty much like what I was saying a couple of months ago. I haven't strayed from the 4 points. So that is my one bias, is I might be kind of adhering to my earlier prediction just because I want to sound right.
Well,
or writer.
Let's see, because we don't even have to wait that long to be proven correct or incorrect. So it's going to be an interesting, however many days, it's about 50 days. It's something like that, 50 to 45 days. Jeb, thank you so much for the time, man. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we'll get another one of these whacked up within about a half a week. We want to try and pump these out pretty consistently and be talking about what is unfolding in real time. And if you want to get in touch with us, how do people find you, Jeb?
I'm on Twitter at Mobute, M-O-B-U-T-E. I also have a dedicated Facebook writing page. It's Jeb Lund's Word Salad. If you want to find me there, you can do that.
Excellent. And if you want to see what I'm banging on about, I'm on Twitter at Tim_Batt, B-A-T-T.
And I just wanted to throw out one promise to our listeners, which is now that we've done all the backstory and once we get into minutia, there'll be way more time for senseless bullshit, I think.
Yeah.
And joking.
True. Yes. We can lighten up. We've laid the groundwork. Thanks very much for the time, and I'll catch you soon, Jeb.
Excellent.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.